Okay, we should start here at the top of Kuf Dalet Amud Aleph. We're continuing with the Mishnah that we had yesterday. And yesterday we discussed the fact that if a person is chocher a specific location, when he's chocher that specific location, then something changes. There's a dynamic that changes within the field that he rented out. And it depends whether he can take a deduction or not over here. Depends on the fact or how he phrased it. So that's what we're up to in the Gemara. It's 2, 4, 5 lines down by the two dots. Imar lo chakor li sedeh beit shlachim zeh. V'amai. Why is it true that even in the Seifa case in the Mishnah, now the Seifa case in the Mishnah is where he specifically states that he says that I want a chakor li sedeh beit shlachim zu or sedeh beit ilan zeh. That he points out that particular field, and it's clear that when he's indicating that particular field, it means with the mayan in it or with the tree in it, and that's what he's focused on. In that case, he could take a deduction. The Gemara says, why? Let's say, why can't he say to him, basically, I'm just giving you a terminology or broad terminology that's used to define such a property. When I use this terminology, it's not telling you about the particulars of this property, but it's a generic term that's used by everybody to describe such fields or such items. For instance, Milo Tanya, don't we have a Braisa? Homer le Chaveiro, person says to his friend, right, Beit Kur Afar ani mocher lecha, I'm selling you a Beit Kur Afar, which means, you know, a Beit Kur, which is a measurement, right, 30 sa'ah, but it can produce, right, a Kur's worth of produce or production, or takes a Kur's worth of seeds. So that area, which is called Beit Kur, he says as Afar. Beit Kur Afar, which means plantable. It's all usable, plantable space. Letach's half a Kur, even though the plantable space or usable space for planting is half of that, Higio, it works. Shalom Achalo Elishma. Then when he sold it to him, when he says Beit Kur Afar, he doesn't literally mean that the whole Beit Kur is plantable as Afar, but rather when he says Beit Kur Afar, he's describing a location, he's describing a size. This is a generic term used for a size of a field. It doesn't mean that necessarily that it's plantable. I think that the Gemara says is qualified with the statement of Hu Debitkari Beit Kur. As long as such a field or that term is used to describe a field, the field that he gave him would have been called the Beit Kur, then that's sufficient. So I would say, for instance, if you went to rent a car, if you go down to rent a car in the rental place, the people behind the counter go to you, okay, here. They show you the car that you're going to get. They say, oh, that car right, that car, you can have that car over there. Then they drive up, and the car that they bring you, it's the exact same car, but it's a different color. Right, they showed you, when they pointed to you in the picture, or when they pointed in the lot, they said it was a red car. Then you show up in a blue car. So you can say to the guy, oh, no, 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 you showed me a red car. How can you give me a blue car? No, because when they point to you and say, I want that car, right, or you say, we're going to rent you that car, when you're describing the car, you're not saying about the particulars of the car in the sense of the color and all the other details. You're talking about that model of car is what you're going to give him. So same thing over here. When you say Beit Kur Afar, you're talking about an area. That's a measurement of land, a measurement of space. It's not about the particular unit that you're looking at, that this it has a fire, this has all the definitive qualities of what I said. It's a term that's used generically to describe such an area. So the Gemara continues, this Braisa continues, and has this by other things. Karma nimor chelecha, I'm selling you a vineyard. Afo pishein bo kifanim. Then when he says I'm selling you a vineyard, doesn't mean that it has to actually have vines in it. Right? Higio. Then he has to keep it. Shalom achar lo elishma. He gave him an area that's called either called a vineyard or it's usable as a vineyard. V'hu demitkari karma. Again, if this field in the past had been planted with grapes and people call it a vineyard, then when he sells it to him, he can sell him a vineyard. A vineyard doesn't necessarily mean vines or grapes inside. A vineyard means a place that at some point in time was used for grapes. Pardes animor chalacha. Again, the same thing with an orchard. Afabishim bo rimonim. Even though it doesn't have pomegranates in it, doesn't have fruit trees in it, he has to take it. Shalom achalo elishma. Again, when he sells them a pardes, it doesn't mean that it is a orchard now with trees in it. It just means that this is called an orchard, either by other people or because it had trees in the past or it's usable for trees. And again, v'hudimitkari pardesa. Again, as long as it's called a pardes, as long as people, other people would call it a pardes, you can't just come along and say, oh, I call it a pardes and I'm selling it to you. No. If people in general, if they looked at this piece of land and say, oh, this is the orchard or this is the vineyard, if he sells it, even though it doesn't contain trees, fruit trees, or it doesn't contain vines in it, grapevines in it, that's still a good sale. Alma. So then, based on this, Braisa, we can say, Amar leishma ba'alma amri loch. So we say from this Braisa, when he sells it to him, he could just say, I'm selling you this what's called this terminology, or the way it's not a definition of its every detail of it. I'm just giving you a generic term that's used to describe such a field. Hachanami. Why can't we say same thing in our Mishnah? Because namele shma ba'amar milecha.
Such a field, or this particular field?
I'm sorry. Not right. Right. I would say it's both. Both are true. Meaning that if people still call this property an orchard, meaning that the people around it would call it an orchard, that would be enough for him to sell it, even though it doesn't have trees in it. And the same thing, if orchard is used as a generic term for anything that could be used as an orchard, then that also should be sufficient for him to sell it and be classified as an orchard. Now, so Gemara says over here also, Hochanami. So say the same thing in our Mishnah. Right. When he comes along, he says, "Stay Beit Hashlachim Zu." When he says this Beit HaShlachim, he means Beit HaShlachim, but not every Beit HaShlachim comes with a mayanit. Not every Beit HaShlachim, right, has a flowing water that come along with it. And when he says Beit HaShlachim, he means, yeah, Beit HaShlachim Zu. Even when you say, again, when you go to the rental place and they say to you that, take that, we're going to get you that car, they're not going to get you the exact same color, right? They're not going to, it's going to be the generally the same car. So same thing, Beit HaShlachim is a generic term. When he says Beit HaShlachim, he means, I'll get you something that people call a Beit HaShlachim. So now, therefore, if the Mayan dries up, people would still call this a Beit HaShlachim, so that shouldn't change, right? It shouldn't change the status of the item. So Amar Shmuel, lo kasho. That's not a problem. Hamanar damele machkir lechoker, hadamele choker lemachkir. This Shmuel statement makes a lot of sense. It depends who is presenting the information. So again, if you're, I like to use the rental car place, right? If the machkir, right, over here, if the balim are giving it to the, right, to the choker, and they're presenting it. So again, the rental car place, when they say to you, you know, we're going to give you that car, they're not talking about every particular detail of the car. On the other hand, if you, the renter, come along and say, I want exactly this, with that means that you are focused. When the buyer comes in, he's focused on the details of everything that he's going to get. He's not looking at, you know, just, I have a whole fleet of cars that I'm going to take. No, when he sees a particular car, when you go into a car lot and you say, I want that car with the fin in the back and the antenna and this and that, that's what you're focused on. When it shows up without that, he says, that's not the car I was looking for. That wasn't the, you know, I have particular needs, and that's what I'm looking for. So here again, when the presentation of the Beit HaShlachim, if it's the owner presenting a Beit HaShlachim, right, he will say Beit HaShlachim, he means the generic Beit HaShlachim. But when the Choker comes and he says Beit HaShlachim Zu, and he points to this particular item or this particular area, his mind is making a cheshbon. He's saying, oh, I'm willing to accept it. I see what's here, and I'm willing to accept it based on what I see here. We're negotiating about something that's in front of us. As opposed to a rental company, which looks at has a broader perspective of a fleet. They just look at utility. They look at cars. So to a balabai, looks at fields. So he just says, I'm going to give you a Beit HaShlachim. It's nothing about this particular field. I'm just going to provide you Beit HaShlachim. So that's what Shmuel says the difference. The difference between the Braisa and our Mishnah is who's presenting the information. In our Mishnah, the information is being presented by the Choker, meaning that the worker is coming and saying to him, this is what I want. In that case, he's being very particular, and it means exactly this item. As opposed to the Braisa, which the seller presenting to the buyer the information. The seller is just telling him, this is, you know, that's what this is called. I'm selling you the field that's called an orchard. I'm selling you a field that people call an orchard. But that's it. He's not presenting that information, that name, as being particular identification of every detail of this property. So, Amarle Machkir the Choker, Shema Ba'alma Amarle. So if it's the Machkir that's saying it, then it's Shema Ba'alma. Then he's just presenting it as a generic term or as a terminology that doesn't focus on the particulars. On the other hand, if it's the worker who's coming along, then kepeda. Then we're talking about a kepeda. He's makpid, because it's his whole cheshbon about why he's willing to work here and how much he's going to take all has to do with the particulars of this property. He's not just willing to say, oh, just give me any property. So Ravina Amar, idividi demalei machkir the choker. Now, both of these, the Mishnah and the Braisa, are both in a case where the machkir is presenting to the choker. Midikamar ze Michlau dekai begava askinan. Our case in the Mishnah uses the term ze. Now, the Chazal do this even in the Torah. They do this in the Midrash all the time. But whenever Chazal see the word ze, that means that you can literally point to it. That's what the Gemara says, the Midrash says on ze kelivan veyu. that when they crossed through the Yamsuf, right, that they could point to a Kodesh Baruch Hu, they could point to the Shekhinah. So the term Zeh Hashem Kivinu Lo, Nagilim Nismechabo. Anyway, anytime the term Zeh is used, it means that it's like literally in front of us, that you're able to identify it and point to it. So that's what Gemara says here. If the term Zeh is used over here in the Mishnah, that's indicative of that they're present. They're right there in the field. So if he says, so then, if he's standing in the field, and he says they're talking about doing or working this field, then why does he have to say Beit Shlachim? The word Beit Shlachim is totally extraneous here. Of course, they're standing in this field. If he says Zeh, it's clear that this is a Beit HaShlachim. They're standing it, they know what it is. So now when he adds the additional term of Beit HaShlachim, Lama Le Demeimar, Dekamalei Beit Shlachim Dekaima Hashto. So the use of an additional term which was unnecessary means that the presentation of that information is indicative of the fact that he's saying this in particular and all the features of it. I mean, had he just wanted to say, you know, any Beit HaShlachim, he could have just said Zeh. As soon as you add additional language, which was unnecessary, that means that you are making more, more definitive, being more explicit about the details of the field that he's going to take. All right, the Mishnah. I'm a kabel, stei mechavero. Person who takes a field from his friend, vehovira. So this is a case, if you remember now, Rav Papa already told us that the first two Mishnayot apply both by Chakirut and by Kablanut. At this point, the Mishnayot afterwards deal with one or the other. So our case here is a case of Kablanut, which means it's a aris, it's a sharecropper. It's only relevant by a sharecropper, because what happens? The person who says, here, I'm taking this field from you, vehovira, and he doesn't work it. Now, if he doesn't work it by a choker, it doesn't matter, because a choker pays a fixed amount every year. There's nothing to talk about. He's going to pay it whether he works it or not. So what's the problem? The problem is that if it's a percentage, then the Baal HaBayit only gets a percentage if the worker actually works the field. What happens if he lets the field lay fallow and now he doesn't work it? Now the Baal HaBayit's out, just like the worker's out. So now, Shaminota, then we assess it. Kamaru Iyalasot. How much it should have produced in that year? Venotenlo. And then he has to pay it. Shekach Kotevlo. That's what he writes in the contract. In Aris, the sharecropper writes in the contract, Im Ovir, if I leave it fallow, Velo Avid, and I don't work it, Ashalem Bemetva, I will pay you in full, meaning I'll pay you as if it had a productive year. So we look at this, what would have been the normal production, we assess what the normal production would have been, and at that point, we give him that percentage, he's got to pay up that percentage. So now, the Gemara says, Rabbi Meir... very good. So the Gemara is going to say that right now. Rav Meir haya doresh lashon hedyot. Here comes along the Gemara, and basically the Gemara is bothered by David's question. If this is found in the contract, then all right, what's going on? So Rashi learns that Rabbi Meir means here that despite the fact that the Chachamim did not demand this, right, and it's not lashon Chachamim, nevertheless, we are doresh. Since this is the norm of language that is placed into a contract, we then can darshan it like we would darshan any other piece of, something that's put in by the Chachamim into a contract. That's the way Rashi learns it. Tosfos says, in addition to that, even if it's not written in the contract, since that is the norm for that area, it's as if it is written in the contract. We have a similar concept by Tanai Beis Din. Right, Tanai Beis Din by Ketubah, even though it's not written in the Ketubah, it's automatically assumed to be in there. So then Tosfos takes it one step further and says that's the case here. That once it becomes the fact, even if it's not written in this situation, it's assumed to be written because that's the norm of business practices. Unless you stipulate otherwise, or particularly stipulate that it's not our practice or we're not going to do this, then you're bound by this practice. That's the way Tosfos explains it. Right, that's correct. Zetanya, we have a brisa. Rabbi Meir Omer, im ovir velo avid, ashalem b'meitva. Because Rabbi Meir in our Mishnah, right, or this is the brisa, but he's obviously the author of the Mishnah as well. He says that, what is the reason that if you leave it fallow that you have to pay? Because of what's written in the contract. So where did he learn his din from? He learned his din from the way the people write the contracts. So because of that, we call it Doresh Lashon Hedyot. So now we're going to have, basically, most of the rest of the daf is basically going through Tanaim who do this, who do exactly that. They're Doresh Lashon Hedyot. They had an issue, so they wanted to know what the halachic solution is. They look at the way it's written by Hedyotot, how the contract is worded, and based on the wording of the contract, they say that's the halacha. All right, so Rabbi Yehuda, Hayad Doresh Lashon Hedyot. What is this? The Tanya, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Adam mevi karban ashir al ishto. So now, a woman, right, has to bring, she has, in instances where she's chayevet karbanot. Chayevet means not that she was no der of a nidav, a korban, but these are karbanot that she has to either bring for, as a chatas, or kapara, or for tum'ah, in order to be machshir. So she's obligated to bring a korban. The husband can't come and say, listen, I own all the possessions are mine. So all the possessions are mine. This woman is chayevet in a korban olev yored. So that means that there are different gradations based on your economic situation. The husband can't say, my wife has no money. So if she has no money, she brings the korban ani. No, we say that the husband is responsible to bring the korbanot for his wife. And since he's responsible to bring the korbanot for his wife, then we classify which korban is bought based on the economic standing of the husband. Now, how do you know that? How do we know that's true? So now, what this circumstance is, and what the gears of the Gemara here is a machlokas Rashi and Tosfos. I'll read you here. What's written here is based on the girsa of Tosfos. Rashi changes the girsa and reads it differently. So I'll read you what's here, and then we'll go over to Rashi's girsa. Shekeach kotevla. This is what he writes to her in the ketubah. Achrayut deit laich alai min kadmat dano. That now the way Tosfos reads it is that any obligations that devolved upon you before this point in time, I accept upon myself. So the way Tosfos reads the Gemara here is, if this woman is chayevet in a karban prior to their marriage, she enters into the marriage, right? Then this statement in the ketubah is an acceptance by the husband to take on the responsibility of providing those karbanot that the woman was already chayevet beforehand. And again, just to be clear, it's only things that she is obligated in, not things that she takes on voluntarily. Right? These are not nidarim and nidavot. Right? These are simply karbanot that she's chayevet. Either, I mean, if she's a yoledet, if she's a zava, right? If she has a korban chatat that she's chayevet for some reason. So if these obligations are something that makes her mutar to eat truma because she has to clear out the tuma. So all of these things are obligations that happen before the marriage. When he marries her, because of the wording of the ketubah, which says that all things that came upon you beforehand, I accept upon myself. So that's how Rabbi Yehuda learned. He says, if you look at the wording of the ketubah, it's clear that the husband takes responsibilities for this. If he takes responsibility for them, that means how are we going to measure the korban that the woman has to bring? We're going to measure it on the economic standing of the husband, because he's the one obligated to bring it. That's the way Tosfos reads the Gemara. Rashi changes the girsa to read that it's not what he writes to her in the ketubah, but it's rather what she writes to him in the receipt. When she gets paid, for instance, they get divorced, and he hands her ketubah. In the receipt for the ketubah, she writes that any obligations of karbanot that existed in the marriage, right, now are terminated as of this point. Meaning that when she writes the ketubah, when he pays her out the ketubah, their relationship has been terminated. When their relationship is terminated, she writes in the shovar, she writes in the receipt that any prior obligations of korbanot, right, that existed, right, are now no longer extant. They no longer are the obligation of the husband, and therefore the husband doesn't have to bring them, number one. And number two is, right, the obligation will be on the woman to provide them, and then they will be determined by the woman. If you can look in Rashi, if you look in Rashi, just to show you it says Hachi Garcin, it's right across from the Mishnah. In Rashi, it says Hachi Garcin and Labatorat Konim, Amri Yehuda, Fikach and Patra, Eno Chayav. If he divorces her, he's not Chayav. Cain, he kotevet lo. She writes to him, Achrain, Deitali Alach, Min Kadmana Matdana. Right, so that any obligations that, right, itali alach, that I have upon you, meaning that these are responsibilities that you had towards me, right, they are dismissed at this point in time through the divorce. So Rashi says we're talking about karbanot that she came into during their marriage, and now after the divorce, right, she is poter, she dismisses the obligation of the husband. Tosfos says, no, these are obligations that devolved upon the woman prior to the marriage, and then she brings them into the marriage, and the husband in the ketubah accepts the obligations. Either way, Rabbi Yehuda is learning from the lashon that's found in the ketubah, or the lashon that's found in the receipt, what the halacha is regarding the karbanot, right, of the woman over here. because it talks about the responsibilities, the obligations and responsibilities. And from that Lashon, he's able to say that, again, according to Tosfos, that if an obligation exists before, the husband accepts all prior obligations of the woman. And according to Rashi, the woman dismisses the husband of all prior obligations. From that, we also see that he would be patur from being the carbon oath, or while they're still married, he is obligated to bring the carbon oath, right? Because if she has to dismiss him from his obligation afterwards, then it's clear that during the marriage that he has to pay for the carbon oath, and then he will be the determining economic factor here. Right now, this is the most explicit and clearest one of the diukim, which is that he used the daresh, again, that which is Lashon Hayetanya. Anshei Alexandria, Hayu Mekadshinet Neshotehem, they used to do Kiddushin, like in the time of the Gemara, they did it prior to the Nisuin. Ubshat Knisatan Lechupa, there seemed to be, I don't know if this was a social practice, or this was a danger that the government was seizing these women, or the strong men were stringing these women, but right before they were about to enter into Nisuin, Bayin Acherim V'chotfin Otam, other people come and grab them. So again, I don't know if this was a social thing. They came and grabbed them and then they married them, meaning that this was other Jews that were doing this, or again, it was an imposition of the government that they came and they took away their wives before they were able to marry them. So then, what was the problem? These children are going to be mamzerim. Why? Because there's already kiddushin, which is a Torah, right, attachment of the husband and wife. And then the new individual who's marrying this woman, right, and produces children from a woman who is already married and never had a divorce. So the product of that marriage are going to be mamzerim. Samarlan Hillel, Hazakein, Hevilu Ktubat Imchem. Bring me your mother's ktubah. Hevilu Ktubat Iman. He saw the Ktubat Iman. Umatzasha Ketubahen. This is the language found in the ktubah. Lishikitich Nesil Chupah Havilili into. Right, that when they wrote the ktubah was written at the time of the kedushin. That's what Rashi says. At the time of the kedushin, they wrote this ktubah, and in the ktubah it says that when I take you into the chuppah, then you will be my wife. So what did they basically do? They deferred the kedushin, or there was a tnai in the kedushin that there actually had to be a chuppah in order for the kedushin to be effective. So what Hillel Zakein was basically saying is that the mafreya, the kedushin, fell apart because you did not fulfill the tnai that was placed into the ketubah, which is that the only way to have kiddushin be consummated was actually to have the chuppah, or actually have nisuin. And the fact that they never had nisuin means that the kiddushin was never effective. And therefore the children were not classified as mamzerim. So here it's clearest where Hillel Zakein clearly is taking out the ketubah, looking at what's written there, and he's saying, based on what's written there, I'm darshaning that this is the psak halacha based on what's written in the ketubah. Reb Shua ben Karcho, Haya Doresh Lashon Hejot, he had the same thing. Titania, Reb Shua ben Karcho Omer, Hamalvet Charbeiro, Lo Yimashkenenu Yoter Mechovo. Person who lends money to a friend should not take collateral in excess of the value of the loan. Shekach Kotevlo, because this is what he writes to him. Now, what he writes to him here is, the case is that he took collateral. He took collateral for the loan. Then the individual who gave him the collateral, the lovet, the borrower over here, needs the meshkon back. He needs to use it. He's asking him as a favor, can he give it back to me? So when he hands it back to him, this collateral, they go to Beis Din, and Beis Din gives them a document, right, documenting this fact. So when they write the document, they write, Shekoko Devlo, Tashlumta, Tidla Chalai, right, that obligation, the payment that I have to you, Kokabai Daichi, right, then is all embedded in this object. So when he hands back the object, he says the payment for this loan will be done through this object. Now, even though now the object is still with the lovet, that object will be, right, the existing or the collateral for the loan. And what they say is they assess the collateral. What is the value of the collateral at the time that he hands it back? And now there's an obligation upon the lovet to pay him either the mashkon back or to pay him that amount of money. So now, what does it say here? It says that this mashkon, right, we assess the value of the mashkon and we say this is now the current obligation. Now, if the mashkon is in excess of what the loan is, if he does that and says the current obligation is now the value of the mashkon, that means that he's going to get paid back in excess of what he lent him, because the mashkon acted as a quasi-payment of the loan. And now when he hands it back the mashkon, he's like, they're reopening the chov on the debtor. When they reopen the chov, if the mashkon's in excess of the debt, then now they're opening up a chov that's greater than the money that he borrowed originally. So it has to be, from this, from the way they write this, it must be that a mashkon is equal to the value of the loan. So now, the Gemara says...
If I don't, that would be a problem of Ritz.
I'm sorry?
If they don't, that would be a problem of Ritz.
Right, correct. That would obviously right to be the issue, because of the way they're writing it. Right now, the Gemara says, Taima dichtivle. The reason it's working here is because he wrote it in the contract. I mean, if they wrote this, if he did not do this, then there would be no kinyan over here. Now, we'll see later what the value of this kinyan is, but it sounds from this that the ability of the individual, the lender, to collect from this collateral, right, will depend on whether this was written or not written over here. His ability to go get this back and to take it back as payment for his loan or his right to do that, right, is debased on the writing of this little wording over here. So Gemara says, is that really true? V'amar Rabbi Yochanan. Didn't Rabbi Yochanan already tell us, mashkano ve'shiv lo ha-mashkon? If a person takes a mashkon and then returns the mashkon, umet, and then he dies, right, meaning that the borrower died, right? Shomto mi'agabe banav. You're allowed to take it back from the children. Now, what's the problem with children? We know that by yitomim, right, metaltalim are not mishubad to a baal chov. When it comes to yitomim, if it's karka, then the baal chov can collect from karka. Why? Because the shibud on the karka existed prior to the death of the individual. So the shibud was pre his death. If that's the case, the shibud already existed. By metaltalin, right, there is no shibud on metaltalin. So if you go and collect from metaltalin, you're really taking piron from the yitomim. And the yitomim, you can't come. There's no shibud where you can go from the yitomim and force them, right, to pay out the loan. So if that's the case over here, what do we see? He took a mashkon, and he handed the mashkon back to the borrower. Then the borrower dies. This mashkon is now with the kids, with the yitomim. So now we say he can go there and grab that back. Well, if he can go grab that back, that sounds like he has a kinyan over this object. Because if it was simple metaltalin, then he couldn't take it. So why? Here we don't see anything that he had to write any lashon. He didn't have to make any statements. Gemara says, no. Ein hochanami that it doesn't matter whether you write it or you don't write it. Right? When you take the mashkon originally and then you return it to him, it remains in your possession, meaning it remains that you have a kinyan on this object. So then, what's the difference whether you write this language or don't write this language? Gemara says, "Ahani miktiva legiron." What the writing of this language helps you for is giron, meaning that if the mashkon goes down in value because the loveh is now using it, it's back in his possession, it's using it, it goes down in value, right? Then if he writes this document when he hands it back, then he's protected because then they assess the value of the mashkon at the time he handed it back. Now, if the mashkon's worth less, we know what the true value should be, and the loveh, the borrower, is going to have to make up the differential. On the other hand, if he doesn't say anything, he took a mashkon originally and he hands it back, then when he gets the mashkon back, they can say, too bad, that's the mashkon that you had, that was the collateral you had, and you have to collect out of that collateral. All right, now, I would just point out, which is interesting, the case over here by metaltalin, right, the reason that it works over here, as opposed to in other cases, is why do metaltalin work, and why do metaltalin not work for shibud by the yitomim, and why does karka work? And that has to do with smichut hadat. Right, we always say the smichut hadat is from the focus of the individual who's going to collect. So the lender, when he looks at collateral, he wants to know that the collateral will be there in the end. So when he lends with land as collateral, he's really somech dat, because he knows that the borrower can't get rid of the karka. The karka is always there. It doesn't move. So he knows that's good collateral. On the other hand, if he has metaltalin as collateral, he's not somech dat. That's what we say. Metaltalin are not mishubad to the loan, because when a person lends money, he doesn't lend it on smach of the metaltalin, because he knows those could disappear and they could be gone. So therefore, he would never lend. But in our case, what happened? In our case over here, there's a mashkon. Right? If there's a mashkon over here in our case, then he does have a smichut hadat over here. Why does he have a smichut hadat over here? Because he already took this object as a mashkon. And now when he hands it back to the individual, and the way we're writing it and we're expressing it is that this object now is going to become the focus of the collection. So since that's the case, when he hands it back to him, he's handing it back to him al smach, that this will remain the collateral, and this will be the item that ensures that he gets paid. So in that case, the metaltalim he has smichus adad on that metaltalim. If that's the case, when the yitomim get the metaltalim later on, in Rabbi Yochanan's case, he can still take it back, because then it is like karka, because he was meshubad from the beginning, prior to to the death of the borrower because he was somechdat on it. As opposed to just generic metaltalin, which he was never somechdat on, if he comes to try to collect them afterwards, then he's trying to take payment from the Yitomim, which he's not entitled to. So that's why, according to Rabbi Yochanan, if it's in your possession as collateral, obviously you can keep it. But even when you hand it back to him and it's metaltalin, either because you have a kinyan on it and therefore it's really still yours, but even if it becomes metaltalin and it's been handed back, in this instance, it is still meshuba to you because you have dat to collect from this particular item, and it works over here. All right. Now, the other thing to point out over here, I mean, it sounds like if he hands it back without this writing, the loveh, the borrower, will not have to make up the differential in the mashkom. Whereas if he does write it, he does have to make it up. But if that's the case, it means that it's not an obligation on the borrower to make up the difference. That means when he writes it in the document, the borrower's making up the difference. What does that look like? That looks like ribit. That sounds like he's paying interest, because it's not an obligation on the borrower, except if you write it. So now when he writes it, he's making a demand of an extra payment on the loveh that he wouldn't otherwise be chayav for. It's as if he's charging him interest. All right, I would agree that ribit generally has to be something in excess of the loan, but here it's in excess of what he would otherwise have to pay. Any excess that you have to pay is classified as ribit. Now, there's two answers. One of them is a little bit along your lines. One is the first answer he gives, Shoal, is that that when the lender is giving it back to him, he knows he's giving it to him for a long duration. That it's not that he's giving it back to him. This is almost what you're saying, which is rather that when he hands it back to him, he's not handing it back to him anymore as collateral, but he's really handing it back to him as a loan. He's lending them the item. And a shoel, in general, is chayav for anything that happens. Any diminishment in value, the shoel is going to have to make up for that giron. It's like what you're saying, Shoel, that the basic case is that when he gives it back to him, there's an expectation he's lending it to him that he's going to get paid back in full. And then in the case where he doesn't take the full payment back, like it's like a discount, which is similar to what you're saying, Shoel. The other answer Tosus gives, which I think is very, very interesting, right? It says, Inami, Rabbanan hu detikon, shichtov, kidei shlo yimne ha-malvim lachzir, kamo shetiken hilel pruzbo. That the Chachamim instituted such a lashon in order to prevent the malveh, because otherwise the malveh would never want to give the collateral or the item back to the loveh. So in order to have the malveh, or make it possible, or ensure that the malveh would give the collateral back to the loveh, the Chachamim instituted such a lashon that would protect him in these types of instances. This is similar to the way Hillel instituted the pruzbol, because people stopped lending money. They saw people didn't lend money anymore. So if they instituted pruzbol, it would open up the markets again. So the same thing over here. If people weren't people would never give back the collateral unless they had this protection. So the Chachamim saw that. So they provided the protection in order that people would give back the collateral. But by Chachamim doing that, it's no longer ribit. It's basically, right? I mean, that is now becomes the standard. The standard is that if you give back a collateral, then you are protected on your loan in order to ensure that you would do such a thing. It's a very interesting concept that Tosfos introduces over here. The Chachamim would institute such protections in order to ensure, meaning beyond, not just like pruzbol, but in other instances, to ensure that there was a liquid lending market. All right, now, the Gemara says, Rabbi Yossi ayore doresh lashon hejot. Another Tano that says also lashon hejot. Why? The Tanya. Rabbi Yossi omer, makom shenagu lasot ktuba, milveh, goveh milveh, lichpol, goveh mechza. So what is this? It's very interesting idea. The way it's written over here is it's not clear exactly who it's constituted a loan on, but it could be either or. The father-in-law comes along to the son-in-law and says, listen, you're going to marry my daughter. Here is what I'm bringing into the dowry. And it gives him a number. Right now, in a place where that which is written in the ketubah becomes a milveh, now that becomes the son-in-law can take this document, the ketubah, and say to the father-in-law, you owe me this money. Because that becomes like a shtar milveh. He's obligating himself based on what's written in there. The other possibility is that when the woman gets divorced, when they get divorced later on, the shtar ketubah will act as a shtar milveh, and the woman can demand what's written in the shtar he has to pay out. But now it's an interesting statement. It's written here, Makom shenagu lasot ketubah milveh goveh milveh. In a place where they write the right amount in the ketubah as the loan amount, then the document will focus as a, it'll become a loan document. I mean that it can be, the son-in-law can make a demand on the father-in-law, or the daughter can make a demand on the son-in-law if they get divorced or somehow she's going to collect her ktubah, she can collect what's written in the ktubah. Lichbol, we've seen this before in the Gemara in Ktubot, but the idea that they used to, when they brought in items to the dowry, they used to over-assess them. They used to over-assess them by double. So they used to double the value of the item that was brought in. So the place that the lichbol govem mechza, then in that place, whatever's written in the ktubah, the son-in-law is only entitled to demand of his father-in-law half of what's written in the ktubah. And same thing with the wife. For the wife at the end, when she comes to collect her ktubah, she can only demand half of what's written in the ktubah. I think it's just an interesting psychological study because, right, they doubled the amount to make it kavod, you know, so it would be kavodik and it would be a large amount. But it's clear that everybody knew that it wasn't the real amount because when it came to collecting it, right, they only got half. So here you have a situation where people, for the appearances, wanted to be a bigger number, but in reality, everybody knew it wasn't that number. It was half of that number. It's very interesting psychologically. Now, Rabbalai, Gabu Tilta. Now, Rabbalai, they were even more. They used to three times the value, so they only collected a third of what was written in Ketubah. Right, so, Mreimar, Megabi Nami Shivcha. Mreimar used to collect the full amount. He says, too bad, whole amount. Whatever's written in Ketubah, that's what you can collect. Don't we have a brisa from Rabbi Yossi that says, listen, when it comes to doubling, I mean, that's the whole point. Rabbi Yossi's Doresh Lashon Hejot, he knows people double the amount. When they write it in there, they don't literally mean that amount. They just give him the amount that is assessed at the double, and everybody knows that you only get in value, you only get half of that. So how can you come here and contradict that brisa? Where it says, Lokasha Akonimine Hadalokonimine. So that has to do with the Kenyan. So this is similar to what we saw yesterday in the daf, which is that here you have to do an additional kinyan. If you do an additional kinyan, right, to solidify, to give a gemira tadat to the fact that what is being offered here, that kinyan will obligate them in the full amount. Because the fact that you did an extra kinyan is indicative of the fact that the person who's getting this somech dat on what you're giving, because went out of his way to make a kinyan to ensure that he would get paid that amount. On the other hand, if it's just stam written in the ketubah, then we say there's no smichut adat, because they know that the practice is that whatever they write in the ketubah is double. So that's it. It has focuses on this kinyan. The kinyan is, right, functions as a gemirat adat for the one who's giving it, but also functions as giving smichut adat from the one who's going to receive it, because now he really believes he's going to get it because he solidified it. They actualized it through a kinyan. So Ravina mishabech v'ktiv lebrate. So Ravina was marrying off his daughter, and he went ahead and he followed this common practice of doubling the amount. So Amrule, so the parties, the son-in-law, I don't know if it's his, the mechutanim, the son-in-law said to him, or the family of the woman of the man that they were marrying, said to him, Nikne mine, demar, let us make a kinyan from you. So he says to them, Amrule, listen, imikna lo michpa, imichma lo mikna, you take your choice. Right. If I'm going to put in the double amount into the ktubah, we're not doing a kinyan. If you don't want to do a kinyan, then I'm going to cut the amount in half because that's going to be the real amount. So it's either or, meaning that the amount that I'm going to give you is really half of what I'm offering right now. So now either you go with the common practice, which is we'll write double and you only get half, or if you want to make this into a kinyan to solidify it, then I'm going to lower the amount to the half amount, which will be the real amount, because I'm not going to get caught in this practice, which you can see here from Ravina, that he accepted this position of Mereimar, right? Because Mereimar had answered to him that a kinyan makes a difference. So over here, right, Ravina is reacting to their wanting of a kinyan, saying that, no, I'm not going to do a kinyan, because that would obligate me in the full amount. So how Gavra, Zamar Lahu, this is an individual on his deathbed. So he says to the people around him, Havula arba mea zuze lebrate biktubata. Give 400 zuz to my daughter in her ktubah. He was marrying off a daughter, and he wants to give the dowry, so he tells the people to give the dowry before his death. So now, they don't know what he meant. When he said, give her 400 zuz in her ktubah, what did he mean? Shalach ravacha breda ravia lekameh deravashi. Arba mea deinun tamne mea. When he said 400, he means give her 400 zuz, which should be written in as 800. Or arba mea, when he says 400, he means write in 400, zuze de'inun matan, but it's really 200. So we don't know, when he said the 400, did he mean that's the monetary amount he's giving, or is that the written amount that he's going to put into the ktubah? Zamar avashi chazinan. Let us see. Iamar havula. If he said to her, give her it, That means literally give it to her. Then Abrame Zuzid Inam Tamnemeya. Because then when he says Havula, it means physically give her the 400 zuz, which is indicating that he wants to write 800 because he's saying to give the money to her. Iyamark Tuvula, if they say write it for her, then it's clear that the Arbame Zuz is the Inimatan. Then when he writes it, when he's saying to them, write 400 into the Ketubah, because then I'll pay 200. So it depends on the verb he uses. The verb is if it's Havu versus Ketuvu. If he writes Ketuvu, Tovu, write it, then we know that he means the Ketuvah. If he says Havu, he means give it, it means give the money. So that's it. The Gemara says, Ikadamre. There's another lashon in Ravashi. I'm Ravashi Chazina. Iyamar liktubata. If he says liktubata, arba mea zuzi dinin tamne mea. Because if he says 400 Jews for the ktuba, what does it mean for the ktuba? It means that's the amount of money that he's giving towards the ktuba. On the other hand, so that would be 400 real zuz, that is 800 in the ktuba. Iyamar biktubata. If he says give her 400 in the right ktuba, not for the ktuba, but in the ktuba, that means arba mea, give 400 in the ktuba, which will really be right arba mea zuzi dinin matan, which will really be 200. The Gemara rejects this. Velohi, doesn't work. Doesn't matter. Lo shna damar l'ktubata. Lo shna damar biktubata. Doesn't matter. If he mentions the word ktuba, arba mea zuzi dinin matan, then it's 400. That's 200. As soon as he mentions the word ktuba, then he's definitely talking about what's being written in the ktuba. Doesn't matter if he says liktuba or biktuba, whatever lashon he uses, that means what's being written in. Ad amar havula stama, until he says havula without any modification. So even back to the first lashon of Rav Ashi, who said, right, I mean, the case here is that he says, Havula, arba mea zuzi, right, give her 400 zuzis, labrate biktubata. So over there, that would not be kinstama. I mean, the way the Rambam codifies it here, he says that if you move the word ktubah in it, doesn't matter if you use the verb havu, it does not help you. It has to be havula, arba mea zuzi, labrate, and nothing else mentioned. It can't be in the ktubah. As soon as you mention the word ktubah, that already makes it into, right, a demand that it's the written amount that he's saying and not the physical amount of what he's going to give. All right, now, next case. Havu gavra, the kabel ara mechavre. So this is an interesting case that we've seen before. Tosfos quoted this case. This is a little chazara for us on asmachta lokanya. So havu gavra, the kabel ara mechavre, accepted as an arisut, as a sharecropper to work the field. Amrei, imuv ranala, yehivin alach alfa zuze. Says, if I don't work it for 1 year, I'm going to pay you out 1,000 zuz. Ovir, right, tilta. He did not leave it fallow for the entire field, but he left a third of it fallow. So amrei naradai. Right, the Nardai say Dinahu the Ayvlay Tlat Mea Tlat Vitlata Vitilta. He should have to give him 333 and a third. Meaning that he should have to give him a third of the 1,000 that he promised him. If he had left the whole thing fallow, it would have been 1,000. So now that he left the third fallow, he pays a third of that 1,000 and paid 333 and a third. So Rav Amar Asmachta, hey, what are you talking about? This is Asmachta Vasmachta Lo Kanyo. This is an Asmachta and Asmachta's no Kanyo. So if you recall, we did this back in the Gemara in Samach Vav, right, we've done it in other places also. Tosfos says that there are actually three levels of Asmachta. There are three different types of Asmachta. If you remember, in a case where the individual is in control of the situation, we do not call that an Asmachta. That is not as Asmachta. Since he's in control, whatever statement he makes is true. Number two is a case where he's totally out of control, where he has absolutely no control on the outcome. There also, it's not considered asmachta lokanya because he never thought up front that he would have control. The problems are in cases where he thinks he has control. Right? In the cases where he thinks he has control and he ends up not having control, that's asmachta lokanya. Tosfos says, but even in the other two cases, well, it's really the one case, where he says that he's in full control and he makes a deal. When he makes such a deal, there's one exception where it's still classified as asmachta lokanya. What's that? That's in a case where he is gazim, where he exaggerates, where the amount is way in excess of what he should have to pay him. So our case over here, had he not exaggerated, right, then this would be a classic case of where it's in his control, and he makes a decision not to work it. So then he has to pay him what the real value of that field would have been. What would have happened if he planted it? So that's a reasonable payment, right, plus it's something that was within his control. So that's not asmachta lokanya. What's the problem in our brice over here? The problem in our case over here is what happened. He promised him 1,000 zuz. He promised 1,000 zuz if he doesn't plant the field. Now, 1,000 zuz is way in excess of the loss that he caused him. So that is gazim. So when you're gazim, even in a case where it's in your control, that is considered asmachta lokanya. So now I did that. That's just chazara on Tosfos. Now that, by the way, Tosfos got that out of our Gemara, we're going to see in a second. So I'm giving you the Tosfos I've had, but now you'll see it in the Gemara again. So but now, so Gemara says, How is this case different than our Mishnah? When our Mishnah says, our Mishnah says, if I don't work it, I'm going to pay you. So why is that not an Esmachta versus the Elev Zuz over here? Gemara says, Hatam lo gazim, hocha, right? Over there, he's not exaggerating. So when he's paying him for the loss that he caused, that's proper compensation. And since it's something that was in his control, that's not Esmachta lo kanya. Hocha came into Amar Milsa Yoterto. Over here, since he says something in excess, something that he did not need to say, either because Tosa says that it's embedded in every contract automatically, or the fact that he added this Elev Zuz, according to Rashi, Guzma ba'amahu de gogozim. And he's exaggerating. Elev Zuz, he's just saying, look, don't worry about that situation. You don't have to worry about it. I'll give you 1,000 Zuz if I don't do it. But it's clear that he doesn't ever believe that he's ever have to pay that 1,000 Zuz. And that's a classic case of Esmachta Lokanya, even though it's in his control. Right, how Gavra, these are nice, interesting cases here. How Gavra, the couple of Arel Shum Shumje, he took on a field to plant sesame. Right, he's going to plant... plant sesame, zarachita. Instead of planting sesame, he ends up planting wheat. Now, sesame is worth more. So had he planted with sesame, the output or the value of the output should exceed that of wheat. But he happened to get lucky. The field produced in wheat enough to equal the value of what he would have planted had he planted, right, sesame. So savarav kahana lemeimar, right, menachile kichishadara. So now, when you plant sesame, sesame is worth more because when you plant sesame, it degrades the property a much greater amount than that of wheat. I mean, it sucks more nutrients out of the ground and makes the ground needs to be worked harder than to plant the following year. So he came out with 100. So if he had planted wheat, now he shouldn't have gotten 100, but it ended up he got lucky and it was worth 100. He planted shum shmei, he would have gotten 100. So now the Baal HaBayit has gotten, either way, he's getting his third or his quarter, according to what Tosu says over here. He's getting his 25%, he's getting his 25, or he's getting his 33 and a third. So he's getting what he would have been paid anyway. But the worker now just saved the Baal HaBayit. Why? Because had he planted shum shmei like he was supposed to, the land would have degraded much further. Instead, he planted chitim. So he actually benefited the Baal HaBayit. So Sover of Kahana says that additional benefit should accrue to the sharecropper, because the sharecropper saved the money. If he saved that money, right, that's something that should accrue to him. So Gemara's Rava responds. Ravashi responds. So Marmalei Ravashi Rav Kahana, Imre Inche Kichesha Arav Lo Klichosh Mara. People say, I'd rather have my land deteriorate than have me deteriorate, which is basically a person would rather plant the more expensive crop or the better, you know, the crop that is more valuable, despite the fact that it deteriorates the property. I mean, that's the intention. The intention of any Baal HaBayit is that he wouldn't want to take the risk with the wheat. He'd rather plant shum shmei, and he doesn't care about the degradation of the degradation of the property or the usage of the property, because that is what people would prefer. People would rather have more money then worry about the deterioration of the field. And since that's the case, right, the kichash of the ara is not something of value, in a sense, to the Baal HaBayit, because he doesn't really care about the kichash ara. That's a trade-off that he already made, right, and he's not thinking about. So he doesn't, since it's not within his consideration now, the fact that the sharecropper saved him that, he says, okay, very nice, but I really didn't care about that. That's not something that really bothers me. So now, how Gavra, the Kabil Ara the Shum Shmei, it's a similar case. He took it for plant sesame, Zarachite. And now he plants wheat. Avdachite tfei min Shum Shmei. This guy got super lucky, and the wheat actually exceeded the value of what would have been produced by the sesame. So Savar, Ravina the Meimar, Yayiv le Shivcha de Beni Beni. Ravina suggests that excess value should accrue to the sharecropper, because that excess value has nothing to do with the Baal HaBayit and wasn't within the expectations of the Baal HaBayit. Right? That's not something that he would ever have considered and wasn't part of what he thought about in the original deal. So that excess should belong to the sharecropper. So Amalei Rav Acha Midifte the Ravina. Atahu Ashpach Aralo Ashpacha. What the suggestion of Ravina is that who created this additional value? The additional value was created by the sharecropper, so he should be able to create the value. So the response of Rav Acha Midifte is, wait a minute, the sharecropper in creating this additional value is not because he just worked harder and he got the more value. He created the aloe vera value because he's still working on the land of this individual. So there is still a contribution by the balabayit to create this additional value, because it's not just the sharecropper, it's the sharecropper plus the land of the balabayit. So how could you just suggest, how could you come along and suggest that it all should accrue to the sharecropper? So now, Amrei Naradai, Hi Iska. So if you remember, this is what we did, this dealt with this in Ezu Neshech. Iska is when an individual hands merchandise to a individual, and that individual is going to take the merchandise and sell it for a higher amount, and they're going to split the profits over here. So for instance, in this case, David has something he wants to sell. He has a phone that he wants to sell. He gives it to Shaul, and he finds out that if he goes to another location, he can sell it at a much higher price. So he hands it to Shaul. He says, go sell it, and we will split the profits, 50% for me, 50% for you. So the phone is worth 100. If you sell for 120, each of us gets $10. Now, what the core, the Karen of the phone, how do we look at that Karen? So we saw this before. Palga milve or palga pikadon. Half of it is a loan, and half of it is a pikadon. Right, because in order for this to work, basically what I'm saying is, listen, 50% of the phone belongs to me, which is that I'm giving it to you to watch, and then we're going to make the profit, and that's why I get $10. I get half of the profit. David gets half the profit because it's his phone. So that's the picadon. The other 50%, even though it's his, instead of taking it as his, he lends it to, you're lending it to Shaul. So now Shaul has borrowed that money, and Shaul's now invested that money in this project or in this investment, and in the end, when he gets it, that $10 is going to belong to him because that's his investment in the project. So now Shaul, in the end, is going to owe back. What are you going to owe him? You're going to owe him the milva. You're going to owe him the loan. You're going to have to give him back the loan. Plus, you're going to have to give him his pikadon, what he gave, plus the profit on his pikadon. That's what you're giving back to him. Palga milva, palga pikadon. If you remember from the Gemara Ezu Neshech, setting up such a transaction is illegal, right, or is improper halachically, because there's a problem of rebit over here. What's the problem of rebit? That you're working for free. The individual who goes and does the work to sell the item is working for the Shaul is working for David for free by going out and selling it and making the profit. So because of the milveh, you're working for free on the pikadon side. So we said before over there, he has to give him schar amala. He has to pay him the fee for doing that work in order to prevent that problem. Or, what's the other alternative? We change the payouts, meaning that the payout, the sharing of the profits and the sharing of the losses is uneven. Right, if you give more loss, you, David, accept on yourself more losses than the share in the profits, that offsets the work that Shaul is doing. So now the Gemara says, "Avud Rabbanan milsa denechle the love venechle the malve." The Rabbanan set this up so it'll be good for the love and good for the malve. Why? Because hashda amrinan palga milve. Right. So now, if you say that this is the case, that this is the way the Chachamim set it up, that an iska is viewed as being half a pikadon and half a milveh, that way both parties can benefit, then what if I lynch, David goes and, listen, I have a $100 phone, I give it to Shaul, and I want him to sell it to make a profit on it, but I'm lending, half the phone is now a loan to Shaul, and the other half is my pikadon. Now, if I lend you money, what can you do with the money? You can do whatever you want with the money. Shaul decides that he'd rather drink away his $50 then go and invest it in this investment. So can he do that? Well, if you say that what David just gave to Shaul is half loan and half pikadon, then yeah. Then Shaul could take the loan and do whatever he pleases with it. So that's what it says here. Right? So Hashad Damrin and Palgo Milve, now that we say half it's a milve, he buy the Mishte Bay Shikra shop here. If he wants to go out, dummy, that he could go out. If he wants to go drink away that Karen, he still owes. Shaul's going to owe you back, David, the $50, right, or the 50 shekel, half the value of the phone, he's going to owe you back. But he can make a choice not to invest in this and make a profit. So, Mar says, Rava responds. So you can see this is like the academic versus the practical. Right, so Rava responds, Rava Amar, the Hochi Korle Iska. That's why it's called an Iska. Darmer Le Kiyavi Lachli Suke Bey. It's called an Iska because you're supposed to do something with it. Not to go out and drink wine, get drunk on it. The reason it's called an isko is because that's exactly, you're supposed to invest it. You're supposed to do business with it. So that's a machlokas Rashi and Tosus, what that means. That it means that it's an isko over here. The way Tosus reads it is that when you go ahead and spend it, then I've lost collateral. I mean, if you go and drink away that half of the Karen, then David has lost his collateral to get back his loan. I mean, the fact that the phone still exists is a guarantee that you will pay back the loan, because the value of the phone is what you're going to pay back the loan. And then once you've sold it, then you have the money and you can get it back. So to ensure that he gets his Karen back, he wants the item to be in existence. That's the way Tosus learns it. Tosus learns that this is part of the protection of the loan. And therefore, when you spend it to drink, you've ruined the situation. You've ruined the circumstance. Rashi says no. Rashi says, what does it mean, Iyusuke Bey? Why can't you drink the beer? Or why can't you go out and drink away the Karen? Because you invested in this project, I know you're going to work harder to get a profit. I mean, that if we're both invested, then I know when you're working to get your profit, I will benefit from the work you're doing to do better for yourself. You also do better for me. But now, when you drank away your Karen, then you're solely, you can say, oh, David, all I'm working for is you. So then you can not try as hard. He doesn't care as much because he doesn't have skin in the game. Right? He's not in the picture because whatever profits made is all going to accrue to David at this point. So Rashi learns that it's a disincentive, right, for the party who would eat it up, who takes the milveh and then drinks it up, for him to work harder. Tosa says, no, that's a problem that the protection that the lender has over here is gone when he spends away the Karen without investing it in the project. Okay, so that's one. Now, next case. Amar of Idi Baravin, v'im mate, nasim metaltalin etzel banav. That if he dies over here, then this half of the Karen becomes metaltalin by his children. So here, now, David, you gave this to Shaul, right? And then, chas v'shalom, something happens, right? Then the item is metaltalin. And by metaltalin, what did we say before by metaltalin? Metaltalin are not meshubad to a loan. So the suggestion of Rav Yehuda Bar-Avin over here is that now it becomes metaltalin. So Rav Amar, again, I think it's like the academic versus the practical. Rav Amar, v'hochi kari le'iska, dimet lo yaseh metaltalin etzel banav. That's why it's called an iska. It's called an iska because, again, over here, and this is what we explained before, is that your focus, especially according to Tosus, your focus is on this object. You are somech dat on this object for the repayment of the loan. And since you have smicha de dat on this object for the repayment of the loan, then it is good collateral. It's not like regular metaltalin that walk. Right, it's not like walking metaltalin, because this is functioning like karka over here, because the iska, the whole point of the iska is that it will be in existence until it's sold for the profit. And if that's the case, then you really do rely on it to get your loan. If he doesn't get it sold, then you're going to get it back, and that's what's going to protect you over here. So that fact that you are so mechdat on it makes it into it that the shibud existed prior to the death of the individual. And if that's the case over here, right, then it's not classified as metaltalin, but yad banav. Okay, next case. Amar Rava, Chada iska utrei shtare pseida de milve, trei iske v'chada shtare pseida de love. So now, what Rava is suggesting over here is something that we saw, if you remember, by the case of Rav Elish. We had this in the case of Rav Elish back on Samachet, is that if you are going to make this type of deal where you have shared profits, in order to prevent it from being rebeat, you have to give an uneven division. So the common practice, this is what Rashi says, the common practice was that Stam Iska was for Tilta, that you would get one third of the profit. The owner would get one third of the profit, but he would accept a half of the losses. So you get one third of the profit, but he would accept a half of the losses, and that's the compensation to the individual who goes out and does the work to get the profit. So now what happens? If there is a one Iska, there was one item, say for instance they were, you had a bunch of a barrel, two barrels of wine that you're going to go do. And he says, I mean, look, take all these barrels of wine and sell them and you can buy back a profit. Now, if you write that into one shtar, that's what should be done. If, on the other hand, you write it as two shtarot, means if it's two different business dealings, then who loses out? In that case, the malveh, the lender, the one who owns it, is going to lose out. Why? Because if it was considered, if it was all one big shtar, then what does he do? He can offset the losses and the gains of different barrels over here against each other. And at the end, you take a net amount. And what the offsetting amount, you take the net amount, and we decide, is it a loss or is it a gain? If it's a gain, I get a third, right? If it's a loss, then I'm going to have to take, I'm responsible for half of that loss. But if you break it up into two components, two shtarot, two separate iskot, what's going to happen now? There's no longer an offset. That means if one iska produces a loss and the other one produces a profit, right, the malveh is going to lose out. The one who owns it is going to lose out. Why? Because in the profits, he only gets a third, and the losses, he has to pay up a half. So in a case, a case where the loss and the profit are equal. He lost 15 on one, and he made 15 on the other, right? So if that's the case, and the losses, he's going to have to pay up 7.5, And in the gain, he's only going to get 5. That means that the Malveh is going to lose out. Had it been one big shtar, he would have been better off. But now when it's in two shtarot, right, then he is going to lose out. The same is true the other way around. If it's trei suke, if it was two different, say for instance, he gave him one item to sell today and one item to sell the next day. So according for the Loveh, he'd rather have those items separated. If you write that into chad shtara, if you write one shtar for both of those items, say to the Loveh, that's a detriment to the one who's going out, the borrower, the one who's going out to make the profit. It's to his detriment now because what? We could do an offsetting. When you put it into one shtar, you're offsetting two different items that really should have stood independently. Now that he's combining them, now he can offset them, and that accrues to the benefit of the Malveh and not to the Loveh. Now, Rava's statement, as Rashi says, is that Eitza Tova, Kamashmalan Rava. Rava's just telling us a good advice is that if it's two items, the fair thing to do is to make two shtarot. If it's one item, then the fair thing to do is to make it one shtar. So that's what Rava is suggesting over here. Okay, v'amar Rava, ha'imon dekabel iska min chavrei upasid. So now, that he took on, this person individual took upon himself to do business for his friend, and he ended up taking the item and lost on the investment. Tarach, then he went ahead, and he never told the individual that he lost the money, that it didn't work out. Tarach umayule, he made it up. He was able to go then and reinvest it and made up the losses. V'lo die, and they didn't tell him about it. Lo matzi amarle, this individual can't go to say to him, Dori meheach pseida bahadai. He can't say to him, listen, originally I lost, 10. And then I went back and I invested and I made back that 10, so now you're whole. So he can't say to him, well, if you remember, in losses, the balabait, or the owner, the malveh, is responsible for half the losses. So you can't go back to him and say, oh, look, I lost 10, so you owe 5 for that. And then I made 10 a profit on what was left over. So on that 10, you only get a third. So you should only get 3 1/3 then. So you're going to actually lose out money. No, you can't say that to him. Why? Mishum darmalei, the malveh, the owner, can say to him, l'hochi tarach the malyute. Why did you go out of your way? You didn't tell me about this loss, but you went out of your way to make up the loss to bring me back the full amount of money. Why? You don't want to get a bad name as a bad investor. You don't want to get a name as a bad investor, so therefore you went out of your way to ensure that the investment was whole. And because you did that, that we're going to use as an offset. We're not going to say, oh, it's two separate transactions. There was a loss, and then there's a gain. No, it's one transaction, which is that you're trying to ensure that I get my principal back so that you don't get called a bad investor. Vama Rava. Rava also suggests over here, Hani Beitrei, the Avde Iskaba Deododi. Two individuals who go ahead and they are as partners going to take an object from an individual and they're going to go sell it to make a profit and they're going to share in the profit. So there are partners who are the borrowers over here. They're partners who are going out to sell the item to make the profit. V'ravach, and they were successful. They were successful and they made a profit over there. So now, v'amalei chad l'chavrei, one of them says the other, ta liflog, let's go split up. I want to split up the profits now. So Gemara says, i'amalei idach nirvach tvei. Right, the other one says, no, we're in a partnership here. I want to go, we should go and make more money. So, Dina Hu Dema'akev, he's allowed to stop him, and he's allowed to say to him, listen, that's the deal that we came into, and I can force you to stay in because our partnership was to go over a certain period of time to make money with this item or with the investment that this individual gave us, and so I can insist that you stay in the partnership until the time period that is expired. V'amarle, so the other person can retort to him and say, wait, havli palga deravcha, just give me half the profits. I'll leave you with the karen, I'll leave you with the principal so you can keep reinvesting it, but I want my half of my profits I want to take out. V'amarle, ravcha the karen mishtabe, no, the profits are connected to the karen. Why? I want the profits in here because if we make a bad investment in the future, I want those profits to protect the karen. I want those to be the offsetting factor to protect the karen. If you take your profits out and now we have a loss in the karen, we're going to be responsible for that karen to pay that loss to the Baal Bayit. V'yamarle, so the other says a better thing. Hali palga ravko palga karno. He says, all right, listen, cash me out. Just give me my 50%. Give me my karen, my profits. I'll leave your karen and your profits, and you'll work with them. He says, "Amale iska la hadadei mishubad." The entire amount is mishubad, is to work as a unit, because right in that instance they are together, meaning that there's a single investment amount. V'imar amale niflog rafka v'niflog karna. So he says to them, "Listen, split the profits, split the karen. V'imatilach pseida." Darina Bahadach. He says, listen, if you give any loss now, I'll pitch into it. He says, Amalei, lo, mazla de beitrei adif. He says, no, it's better to have two than one. So he was not willing to acquiesce to the fact that even though this guy, the individual, the other partner, is willing to guarantee him if there's a loss that he'll pitch in or he'll make up for it, nevertheless, he can say to him, listen, I don't want that. I want the situation where all the money's in together and you're in with me. Because he feels that the partnership, the mazel of two people together, is better than one mazel by itself. And therefore, he can insist that the individual stays in the partnership with him. So Tosus truly says that in all the cases he could have said that to him. In all the cases where he's trying to catch out, he could say to him, mazel de betre. He could just say to him, look, the mazel of two is better. But he says, each one of them, we had a better answer. In the first case, we had the answer, listen, if you take the profits out, then the Karen's not protected. In the case where he wants to take out both the Karen and the Revach, he's going to say to him, listen, I don't want that, because he could say to him, listen, I need your money in here because then I can make bigger, more investments. I can diversify. If I can diversify, then even if I have one loss here, then the other will make up in a profit. So I'd rather have more money. I'd rather have your money in here because it's Meshubah. The whole unit is Meshubah together to be invested as a whole, meaning either in multiple items, but to ensure that we have profits. And I'd rather have more money in here because that will protect me better. In the last case where he says, okay, I'll take my money out and I'll give you a guarantee to make up any losses, he can still say to him, no, because Mazla Garim, that the mazel of having two individuals together is greater than having a single individual, and therefore he insists that he stays in the project. So Tosas asked the question over here, why did Gemara come up with this case where it's two partners who are actually coming together in order to do business? Why don't we just say there's a normal case of a iska, normal case where the individual comes in and the balabait and the person who took on the owner and the person who took on to go and sell it to make the profit, that they can't back out. That they can both insist, each of them, through the duration of the time that they are together, they can insist both parties live up to their agreements. How come the Gemara gave the case as being a case where it's two partners who borrowed it over here? So it says that's because it's not true. It's not true by the case of a regular iska. By the case of a regular iska, the individual who takes the item to go and sell and to make a profit, that individual can back out at any time. Why can he back out at any time? Because he is a din like a poel. And a poel is allowed to walk away, even b'chatzi yom, is allowed to walk away. So as soon as he can walk away in the middle and say, listen, I made a profit, here it is, I'm giving it back to you, I want to terminate our relationship, and he's allowed to do that. On the other hand, Tosafot does say that the balabait here is bound to stay in here, because when he offered him half that is a loan, right, is now outstanding, and the loan that's outstanding, you can't call in early because there's a date or a due date for that loan, and the other half that's a picadon, right, he gave him the rights to use in order to make a profit, so now he can't rescind those rights. So Tosafot says the reason the Gemara didn't give the example of being a regular case of iska is because the din is not exactly the same. True, by the balabait, the din would be the same as two partners who go in together to do this type of, do an iska. Two partners who are going to take iska, meaning from someone else, to make a profit. That's true by the balabait, but for the person who's taking on, the person who's going out to do the business and to make the profit, that individual can back out at any time. He can terminate the relationship any time because he's like a regular poel, and a poel is entitled to stop even b'chatzi yom. Okay, we'll stop over here.